This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1 p.m. Wednesday, March 4th, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Elam, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today in House Resources, we will hold hearings on two bills, House Bill 208 from Representative Mears relating to LNG import facilities and House Bill 321 from Representative Josephson relating to state wildlife refuges. First up, we have House Bill 208 from Representative Mears. This is the second hearing on this bill in House Resources. The bill was previously heard on May 7th in the first session. We have available online for questions Julie Vogler, Utility Master Analyst with RCA, and Laura Barson, Chief Administrative Law Judge at the RCA. Representative Mears, please take the testifier table with your staff and begin your presentation. And before you begin your presentation, let the record reflect that we are joined by Representative Colomb at 1:01 p.m.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Freer, Co-Chair Dibert, and members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, I am Representative Donna Mears from House District 21, South Muldoon. Thank you for hearing House Bill 208, LNG Import Facilities. We did hear this bill once before, but I'd like to refresh members. I'd like to hold questions until the end, since we do have those folks from the RCA online. Slide two. House Bill 208 is a consumer protection bill, clarifying that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has jurisdiction over a utility gas sales contract originating in an LNG import facility. So contracted rates are just and reasonable. This bill repeals a single line of statute. And since it's a short one, I'll read it. AS 4205-711V, a liquefied natural gas import facility under the jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is exempt from this chapter. This subsection has created confusion about the RCA's authority to regulate gas sales from an LNG import facility that is also under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's jurisdiction for facility permitting. The interpretation became the focal point of an RCA hearing on January 28th in 2025 as an NSTAR rate case was challenged by multiple interveners. I'd like to note that this issue was not the subject of the docket, but did call into question RCA's authority. Your packet includes a docket from that hearing labeled U25-0045 and a findings sheet from the RCA. I'm going to briefly highlight some of the relevant portions of the docket for the committee. Slide three. The RCA shared a one page provided in your packets and shared on this slide in response to the arguments raised in the January 28th, 2025 hearing. They reiterated the following. The RCA has statutory jurisdiction over public utilities. They focus on rates, not the act of importation. Their duty to the oversight of contracts of natural gas, their consumer protection role, no expansion of authority claimed in regulating import agreements, and their jurisdiction is triggered by fuel status, not origin. Slide four.
I just want to let the record reflect that we are joined by Representative Prox at 1:02 p.m.
Thank you. So NSTAR argues that FERC's jurisdiction over site permitting does not negate the RCA's authority in rate setting. They liken this to the RCA's authority to regulate oil and gas sales in the Cook Inlet. Slide five. JL Properties and RSD were among several interveners in the case. They argued against the RCA being able to exercise jurisdiction over contracts originating in LNG import facilities because of the plain language in AS 4205-711 subsection V. They cite United States Code 717BE1, exportation or importation of natural gas, LNG terminals of the Natural Gas Act, which states, FERC, quote, shall have the exclusive authority to approve or deny an application for the siting, construction, expansion, or operation of an LNG terminal. They argued that, end quote, they argued that all contracts tied to an LNG import facility would be under FERC's jurisdiction. So this was just three positions from that docket. And as you can see on slide six, oh, we're at the end here. This is just three positions from this docket. And as you can see, AS4205-711V created confusion and slowed down our regulatory process. In this case, it's my understanding that this section of statute did not change the outcome of the hearing, and its removal would not change its result, as the RCA asserted its longstanding authority to regulate natural gas contracts. However, since there was confusion from interveners on the applicability of the RCA jurisdiction, it took up time during the consideration of the docket. We frequently hear criticisms of the RCA timelines being longer than parties would like, and this statute has contributed to this problem and why we seek to remove it. I'd like to thank the committee for their time and urge your support for this bill, House Bill 208.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Fields, then Representative Crox.
Through the chair, I guess I just have a question about the sponsor statement. It says the second to last clause in the sponsor statement says, thus by removing the RCA from the economic regulation of an LNG import facility, the current law leaves no regulatory body with the authority to protect consumers in the rate setting process as utilities enter into contracts with LNG importers. And I was wondering if maybe the bill sponsor might entertain just a clarified sponsor statement that RCA under current law retains authority over reviewing contracts for gas supply, which is different than the facility itself. Is that something that the sponsor might entertain?
Through the chair to Rep. Fields, I haven't considered doing a revised sponsor statement for anything that hasn't come up in my time, but we have definitely learned a lot more. RCA can be confusing and their processes, and it's been a few months, and I think the presentation today was probably more clear than it was in May as we've worked some things out and gotten down to the heart of the issues. So I think that's something that we can consider.
Okay. Thank you. And just for committee members who haven't read the RCA decision from April, I think the RCA is pretty clear. They definitely can regulate a gas sales contract. They do not have regulatory authority over the import terminal. And I actually think the status quo is really good for consumers, because if you go read that April case, the RCA rejected a proposal from a utility that would have had consumers on the hook for costs associated with the import terminal. So in this way, we do have a degree of protection over a gas sales contract. That's a good thing. But we don't have the exposure of, potential cost overruns and everything else associated with a large construction project. So I think the status quo is positive for consumers. And I think if this bill could advance in a form that reinforces that status quo, but I would just want to be really clear in all the documents that we support that status quo for the purposes of consumer protection. And I just see an opportunity to clarify in that sponsor statement. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Let the record reflect that we were joined by Representative Sadler at 107. Next in the queue is Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, is the primary concern is that RCA would not be regulating the prices sold from the terminal? Because it does create another level of regulatory oversight, which has its disadvantages. But what is the primary concern that you're trying to address with this bill?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Prox. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, can you go back to this one? FERC has siting, so the physical structure of the facility. In Alaska, FERC only has jurisdiction over LNG facilities and dams, and it's only the physical structures. In the lower 48, they have a huge role with consumer protection and rates. They don't have this role up here. Our RCA does that. So since this is how we do things, having that line in there that RCA can't jurisdict where FERC does, it creates confusion because they're doing two different things. So if you got a building permit, but since you got a building permit, we can't regulate your costs, is not where we want to be.
And just for committee members who joined a little bit after we got started, we do have Julie Vogler, the utility master analyst with the RCA, and Laura Barson, chief administrative law judge with the RCA, and they can address any questions you might have as well.
Okay.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Prox?
Yeah, follow-up. So I guess today Hilcorp bought out Marathon for the LNG import facility, as I recall. And are we going to hear from the folks that are investing in Alaska to provide the gas and also the utilities? Or do you plan on inviting them to testify about this bill?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, I believe some of those arguments are laid out in the docket and where several folks stand, including NSTAR.
Okay. And could you
follow up?
Yeah, follow up. Could you give me that docket number again, please? Because it takes me a week to figure out.
It's up on the screen.
The docket should be provided in your committee documents as well, but it is docket U-25-004. And we have it should be in your committee documents from today.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
It's right here, Representative Prox.
Okay.
Next in queue, Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So I just want to get some clarification. So if this passes, so are you saying that the cost to build the import facility may not be rolled into rates per ratepayers?
Through the chair to Representative Coulomb, I'm going to pass this to the RCA, but okay. This issue is separate from what the docket was about. Mm. It was a clouding issue as they were looking at that issue of recovery of rates for building a facility. But I'd like the RCA to chime in on that. Start with Ms. Vogler.
Okay. Ms. Vogler, did you hear the question?
Through the chair, Julie Vogler. Yes, I did, and Judge Barson will be replying to this question. Through the chair, this is Laura Barson. Could you please repeat the question for me?
Yes. So does this bill mean that the cost of the import facility, the costs associated with building that, cannot be put into a contract onto ratepayers? That expense has to be separate? They're not allowed to include that in the ratepayers' costs?
Through the chair, Laura Barson, for the record, no, I don't believe that is an accurate statement. Under the Alaska Public Utilities Regulatory Act, which is 4205, the RCA does possess jurisdiction over public utilities. And so that would include both the review and approval of any type of gas supply contract. And that also includes the review and approval of a just and reasonable rate. And so the RCA does continue to possess that jurisdiction over public utilities in the state, and that jurisdiction extends to the rates and surcharges imposed on consumers of those public utilities.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
So just be clear, so even though it's clear that FERC has a responsibility for the import facility and RCA has responsibility for rates, they could still propose a rate that includes expense of the facility, correct?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fields?
Thank you, and as follow-up to that question, I think to the same person who was just speaking, because of the structure under current law, that structure could allow the RCA to say certain costs would be unreasonable or potentially certain profit margins would be unreasonable to pass on in gas rates. Is that correct? So, yes, it allows recovery of a facility in a way that's reasonable to consumers.
Ms. Barson?
Through the chair, Laura Barson, for the record. Yes, I do believe that is an accurate statement. The RCA does not possess jurisdiction over an import facility that is subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the FERC. However, to the extent that we have public utilities in the state that are regulated by the RCA under the Alaska Public Utilities Regulatory Act, and to the extent that those regulated public utilities do attempt to impose costs, we do maintain that jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction extends to both approval of costs and surcharges and also disapproval of costs and surcharges.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Ms. Larson. I guess we are, these are some arcane and very specific legal points. When you say RCA authority does not extend to a facility that is exclusively permitted by FERC, help me understand the parameters of that modification exclusively. I mean, every gas project is going to be connecting to the gas network in Alaska. So does FERC, you know, what does exclusive mean? How far does it extend?
Through the chair, the FERC maintains exclusive jurisdiction under Section 3 of the Natural Gas Act over LNG import facilities. So the scope of that jurisdiction is going to be defined by the definition of a particular import facility.
And follow up?
There's
the obvious question, and who defines what the extent of that is?
Through the chair, Representative Laura Barson, for the record, that would be the FERC.
So it's up, follow up. It's up, basically it's up to FERC to decide where its jurisdiction begins and ends and whether, right?
Insofar as it relates to the import facilities and the definition of that import facility, correct. I believe that's correct.
And not to go the reduction ad absurdum, but if FERC decides that it wants to regulate the last mile in Fairbanks of natural gas importation, is that allowable? Are there any caps on FERC's extension of jurisdiction?
I don't believe that's a question I can answer for you.
Fair enough, yeah. So it'll hang.
Are there any other questions from committee members? Seeing no questions, I will now open public testimony on House Bill 208. Is there anyone in the room or online who would like to testify? Seeing no one in the room and no one online, we will now close public testimony on House Bill 208. I would now like to seek the will of the committee. Co-Chair Dibert, do you have a motion?
I do. Co-Chair Freer, I move House Bill 208, Work Order 34-LS0933/A from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection?
Object.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
Well, yeah, thank you. I guess in my view, the Cook Inlet gas shortage is a result of price control that happens to be set below what potential producers think they need in order to turn a profit. So they just didn't show up, or they went bankrupt and moved out. And this has happened a couple of times, in my view. So I don't think, in the end, it's in the public's interest to even set the price low enough that somebody thinks they can't make money off of it, and then the producer asks us to lower the royalty rate so that the consumers in one area are getting an advantage over another, and essentially that gas, I don't want to say it's subsidized because it's taxed, but it's something that treats others in the state differently because they don't have either the political power or the direct interest in the situation at hand. So I don't agree with getting the RCA involved, and I think we need to explore some of the some of these issues a little bit more before we advance this out of committee.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Fields.
Thanks. Just I just wanted to, through the chair, let Representative Prox know the RCA actually has authority right now. This bill doesn't change that. It attempts to clarify it, but the way that RCA will review gas supply contracts is through that just and reasonable framework. And for an example, a regulated utility like NSTAR, which has a set rate of return, what the RCA will do is say, hey, were the costs of this import facility that got built reasonable? Did you do what you could to control those costs? Is the gas supply contract fair? Is that regulated? Are we adhering to that regulated rate of return? And the RCA will apply that equally across any gas supply contract. So there's certainly not regional discrimination or variation, and this bill doesn't add a layer of regulation. It attempts to be consistent with that the most recent RCA decision. And I think when you go back and look at previous legislative action, the legislature never attempted to say the RCA shouldn't have regulatory authority over a gas supply contract. The legislative record, I think, is pretty clear. That was about an import terminal as a facility. So I would see this bill as being consistent with both the legislative record and the intent of previous legislation and with what the RCA has decided vis-a-vis import terminals and gas suppliers.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Mears, do you have any? Okay. Representative Prox, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Hall.
Yes.
Representative Mears.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Pass.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Colon.
Yes.
Representative Elam.
No.
Co-Chair Dibert.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Co-Chair Freer.
Yes.
Six yeas, three nays.
And with a vote of six yeas and three nays, House Bill 208 passes from committee. We'll now take a brief at ease to sign the report. Back on record in House Resources. Next up, we have House Bill 321 from Representative Josephson. This is the first hearing on this bill in House Resources. Representative Josephson, welcome. Welcome back to House Resources. Please take the testifier table with your staff and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel better than I sound for the record. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13, South Midtown. With me is Joe Meehan, an aide who is working principally in natural resources-related legislation for me. Before the body is House Bill 321, which is, in some respects, a cleanup bill, we think an important one, fixing some problems with current state game refuge, sanctuary, and critical habitat area language in mostly, I think, Title 16. The bill is mirrored on an effort from the Walker administration in about, say, circa 2017, which looked at truing up some of the boundaries. So one of the things that I think, if someone asks, Madam Chair, what is the most important thing this bill does? Tell me the one most important thing. I would say that it corrals, if you will, all lands that have been treated or are being regulated as state game refuge sanctuaries and critical habitat areas, but aren't officially within the borders in the blue books, in the statutes. So in that respect, it's a fix-it bill or a truing up bill. So you look at the meets and bounds, the on the maps, and you say, is this still what it purports to be? And often it's a little bit bigger because the department has received, and Mr. Meehan can tell you more about this process, it has received from sometimes private landholders contributions expanding the boundaries of areas like Creamer's Field in North Fairbanks. So that is the main thing it does. It does ancillary things related to that, all involving refuges and sanctuaries. And importantly, it recategorizes all of these different titles, refuges, sanctuaries, critical habitat areas, into two, which would become just wildlife refuges and sanctuaries. So everything, instead of having three, four different designations, there would be wildlife refuges and sanctuaries. Importantly, it doesn't change the way those lands are typically treated. So it's not that this is, in that respect, an environmental effort to hem in the capacity to use the lands, whether it's for subsistence or trapping or hunting. Instead, it refines those, and Mr. Meehan can describe, part of it is because of the language conflict with federal law, federal reserves, which have similar language, creating conflict in the user's mind. It's designed to simplify that. It also, in some ways, for example, has some ancillary topics. So, for example, you'll hear about how there are user conflicts when people want to go to shoot game or to target practice, as the case may be. And how do we deal with these competing interests? None of this, I think you'll find, there may be some elements that are designed for public safety. So the public is told, look, you're downrange from a shooting range, and we don't want you to be shot. But I don't think you're going to find anything in here that's going to create public outcry that this is some sort of infringement, other than in the absolute need for public safety. It does, in one area in particular, and that is McNeil River State Game Sanctuary, it does expand those boundaries so that an area between the McNeil State Game Sanctuary and Katmai, which I think is to the north, to the south, is covered. Is that the Kashanak? Kamishak area. That those areas would also be precluded from hunting in the interest of protecting that important sanctuary and, you know, world-renowned habitat protections for big brown bears there. So I'm going to turn this over. If there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to try to do that. There are other things here that are, as I said, ancillary. For example, Mr. Meehan will describe how if Fish and Game on state land wants to build an amenity. Maybe they want to build a cabin. Maybe they want to build a bench or an outhouse. DNR will charge them a fee for that, and this would say, look, we're sister agencies. Let's dispense with that and not require that any longer. So there's some things that It all relates to the same topic, but they're as I said for the third time now, ancillary issues that are addressed in the bill as well.
Thank you. Before we turn it over to Mr. Meehan, I think we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And boy, looking at the sponsor statement, specifically, I think there's 10 actual activities and action verbs. So that's a lot to dig through, and the size and heft of the bill reflects that. But one of the things the sponsor said, something is, I'd like to point, ask a question, right? Amend certain refuge jurisdictions to match important habitat boundaries. It sounds like you want, you're trying to say, well, if the habitat supports certain populations, we should match the refuge boundaries to the population. It almost sounds like it's sanctioning, it's almost like giving title of the property to squatters. I mean, if we're changing our boundaries to reflect that, it just seems a little odd to me. So I've got a lot of digging into this. There's no real question about it, but I don't know if I'm mischaracterizing it, but I'm just trying to get my head around what this actually does. There's a lot that it does, and I look forward to the presentation of the bill thoroughly, but that's one that really caught my ear.
Sure. And through the chair, Representative Sadler, Mr. Meehan will be able to describe, and I think you'll find him a real great source of knowledge on this bill. He'll be able to describe whether the expansion to cover habitat areas is a part of the accepting of contributions made by either purchased or made by private entities that I described, or is it unrelated to that? Are there no new lands, but instead we're trying to expand habitat? And frankly, I'm trying to recall the answer to that question. I do want to tell you about Mr. Meehan briefly. He has probably a 30-year career in this sort of work. First, and I may get some of the chronology wrong, but he worked for U.S. Federal Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife. And then he worked for DFNG for approaching 20 years, managing the very parcels at issue here. So he's walked many of these lands, if not all of them. As an example, he would be embarrassed to hear this, he may be, but he's an expert, for example, on the walrus sanctuary off Togiak in the near shore Bering Sea. And so I think he's going to be able to answer every single question, or darn close, that you can pose.
That's a big buildup.
I believe we have a... Did you have a question, Representative Fields?
Through the chair, I was just going to say to Representative Sadler, the maps are really helpful. I think if you flip back to the maps, those are probably clarifying. Thank you.
Mr. Meehan, go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you. Co-chairs Fryer and Dybert and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. My name is Joe Meehan, staff for Representative Josephson. First, to correct one thing, is I'm probably a little bit older than Representative Josephson realizes. Just to give you the background, I had a 40-year career in state and federal land management agencies, and 25 of that was with the Department of Fish and Game. I retired about 2.5 years ago, and in full disclosure, I oversaw the lands and refuges program that we're talking about today at the Department of Fish and Game. However, I fully recognize I can no longer speak for the department, so everything I'm presenting to you today is based on my past experience. What I want to do is provide you an introduction to what we call the Special Areas Program. And as Representative Josephson mentioned, that includes state refuges, critical habitat areas, and sanctuaries. I don't plan to go through the sectional analysis line by line because of its length. But I will give a brief overview of all the sections of the bill and what it basically means to managing these areas. First of all, I'd like to introduce the program, and we'll start with Alaska's first protected state area of any kind. It was designated by Alaska's second legislature in 1960, the Walrus Island State Game Sanctuary in Bristol Bay. At the time, it was this group of seven small islands supported the largest and only consistently used terrestrial haul out for Pacific walrus. All other terrestrial haulouts have been abandoned prior to statehood due to commercial harvest and other disturbances. Following the Walrus Islands, McNeil River State Game Sanctuary in 1967 protected one of the world's largest consistent congregation of brown bears. And then over the next several decades, 30 more areas were added, including refuges, critical habitat areas, and one more sanctuary that was created, most of those being created in the 1970s and 80s. The most recent area to be created was the Homer Airport Critical Habitat Area in 1996. Many of these areas that were established as state areas mirrored the efforts that were done to create federal national wildlife refuges, particularly in the lower 48 states during prior decades. And that's in many of them were oriented towards waterfowl habitat, and the efforts were initiated by waterfowl hunting community. So today we have 32 of these areas. As this map shows, most of them are located in Cook Inlet and down in the Bristol Bay area. There is a couple up around Fairbanks and a few down here in southeast Alaska. The primary purpose of refuges and critical habitat areas is to protect habitats and wildlife populations while allowing public use. The definition of the purpose statement for critical habitat areas puts a little bit higher bar in their statutory purpose. And then for sanctuaries, which there are three, they each have varying statutory purposes, but they're focused on populations of specific species. Two of them for brown bears, one for Pacific walrus. Public access into the sanctuaries is managed through permits. And somewhat uncharacteristically, there is a limited hunting that is done within the Walrus Island State Game Sanctuary. So a little bit of legal background. The state constitution allows the legislature to remove from public domain special purpose sites. That includes, you know, areas of recreational importance, cultural importance, wildlife, habitats, state park areas, state forests. The legislature did not remove refuges and critical habitat areas from the multiple use mandate, so we'll talk about that in a little bit. But these areas are open to commercial and industrial uses like extractive activities, provided that their primary purpose, which is, again, to protect habitats, is maintained. Just to point out, again, Walrus Islands is the first area protected in the state in 1960, and then Kachemak Bay State Park was the first park in 1970. As far as acreage goes, the state refuge program, which I just use the term generally refuge program, has 32 areas and almost 3.3 million acres, about the equivalent size of our Alaska State Park system. And this refuge program is the largest in acreage program in the United States as far as a state-run program. All sorts of activities are allowed in these areas: hunting, fishing, trapping, subsistence activities. Wildlife viewing and photography is a big popular activity. General recreational activities occur in almost all of these special areas. And as I mentioned, most areas are open to commercial and some industrial activities. And including some areas that even have oil and gas activities in them, provided, again, that the activity can be done to protect the primary purpose of protecting habitats.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's some extensive slides in this. Is it possible, or is there any place in the packet that gives us a table showing us what a refuge and a park and a forest area and a multiple use, what those allow and don't allow? You may be speaking about those, but it's really hard to capture the nuances, because when I hear refuge, park system, forest, I think land set aside, and I don't know for what particular purposes. Is there some place I can reference to find out the particulars anywhere in our packet?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't have anything in the packet that outlines those differences. And I can't speak from direct knowledge about the purposes for state parks and state forest areas other than in generalities. But certainly for a state park and all these fishing game managed areas, again, it's a natural resource that's being protected.
Right, to follow up.
Follow up.
And yes, there's recreation and sightseeing and policy pertaining to game and so forth, but they all kind of morph together in an amorphous definition unless I have something specific. So if the definition and the specifics of a refuge and a forest and a preserve are going to be important legislation, that's something I'm going to have so I can tell the fans from the stands here.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. The bill, and I will get into it a little bit, does go into what the purpose statements are for refuges, sanctuaries, critical habitat areas, and what this bill is proposing to change some of those too.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Meehan.
And many of these areas also do provide for transportation and utility easements. So once again, fish and game special areas includes five different designations. We have wildlife refuges, game refuges, critical habitat areas, wildlife sanctuaries, and game sanctuaries. House Bill 321 is proposing to consolidate all of those titles into just two, which would be wildlife refuges and wildlife sanctuaries. Partly it would be done to simplify titles in these areas. It would rename the critical habitat areas to refuges, partly to avoid confusion with a critical habitat area managed by the state and critical habitat designation under the Federal Endangered Species Act. So it would rename all those critical habitat areas as refuges, and we would substitute the term wildlife refuge and wildlife sanctuary in for game. Games are traditionally hunted species. Webster defines game as animals under pursuit or taken in hunting. So wildlife is more inclusive. The individual purpose statements for each area will remain unchanged. So in other words, in statute, most of the areas that were designated have an individual purpose statement, but then there are overriding purpose statements for all refuges and another overriding purpose statement for all the critical habitat areas. Those two purpose statements would be combined for just refuges. And again, it would be to protect habitats and fish and game populations. And the other thing the purpose statements will do, which is not currently in statute, is clearly allow fish and game to manage public uses and manage those uses to avoid conflicts between users and also to assure that those uses are protecting habitats. Again, the primary purpose. And the bulk of HB 321 addresses boundary changes, and those use either meets and bounds, which is a surveyor's description, or the public land survey system, which uses township and ranges. So the bulk of this bill is going through a lot of the existing and some of the changes that we're proposing to make in this bill. The reason boundaries need a changing, there are several reasons. One is we're adding limited areas that were omitted prior to legislation or into the initial enabling legislation. And we assume a lot of these areas were inadvertently missed out or left out, possibly due to less refined mapping and aerial imagery. And these may answer some of Representative Sadler's questions about habitat. And we'll get into that in just a second. Some of these areas, the actual legal descriptions are an error. Back in the 70s, they made errors when they were describing these boundaries. Some of the changes need to be made because there's land within a refuge boundary which needs legislative approval to be included as part of the refuge. And then in some cases, there are lands outside of the area's boundary that were acquired to protect those particular habitats. And I'll go through each of these areas that need changing on the maps. And if there are any questions as we're going through, it might be easier to stop me as we go through so we don't have to run back through a lot of these maps. So I will start with the Cape Newenham State Game Refuge. And hopefully this cursor will point out the lands. So there's two small sections that were just left out of the intertidal portion of Shagvan Bay part of the Cape Newenham State Game Refuge. And just for clarification, too, this State Game Refuge overlaps what is now called the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. But it's just two small pieces within the tidal area that were not in the original description. A similar scenario in Kachemak Bay up here in the northern shoreline. Just a small section of land that was presumably inadvertently left out of the legal description, either mapping or aerial imagery error that was made years ago.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Elam.
Thank you. A lot of data, covering a lot of ground here pretty quick. I don't mean to necessarily slow you down too much, but you're hitting on a lot of areas where I know a lot of outdoors and go hunting and fishing and access. As you're going through the maps, could you maybe kind of help us, or at least myself, know what additional restrictions would be added onto these areas of land? So like Kachemak Bay there, what would that change within that community?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, nothing would change that isn't already in place for the rest of the area. For instance, in Kachemak Bay, whatever regulations are in place for Kachemak Bay would be applicable in this small addition as well.
Let me follow up.
Follow up.
Sometimes, though, the small areas where they have, say, like anadromous waters, they have intentionally left certain areas out so that you can put a boat ramp in or various areas so that you can have access. And access is a big issue. So like on Funny River, for example, on the Kenai River, you know, on the north side of the river, we have, what, 36, 37 access points. But on the south side of the river, we only have 2 access points. And, you know, on the anadromous water supply side of the south side of the river, we have 1 section of land that's 25 feet wide out of 36 miles of riverside that you can access from. And so what I would be weary of is adding additional access restrictions to these small pockets because they may have intentionally been actually left out.
Madam Chair, Andy Josephson for the record. I think that Mr. Meehan can, he could pick this up himself, but the bill actually strives to ensure statutorily that there's access to new areas that would be enfolded into any of these land designations so that the public can access the new area. So, and he can describe that better. Just wanted to offer that comment.
Okay, through the chair again, Joe Meehan, Representative Elam. Yeah, most of these areas that are going to be added in are not areas that would be considered for boat ramps or other facilities to be added in. The example for Shagvan Bay, very remote area, it's just intertidal seagrass beds that are being added in. So in my 25 years of managing this program, I'm not aware of any conflicts that any of these small additions would have on these areas. And as Representative Josephson said, overall, House Bill 321 will actually give Fish and Game increased authority to manage for public access and public activities than what they already have.
If I may follow up.
I guess I do have some concerns with some of that. Like on the south side of the river, we've been trying to get access for years, and we've been fighting with actually the state to get access to that for all of those communities down there. So I guess I still have some concerns, but I will listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elam. Mr. Meehan?
Okay. Next would be the Fox River Flats at the head of Kachemak Bay. Very flat intertidal area. On this lower map, it's these areas that are in blue that would be added. And again, they're just areas that presumably were inadvertently left out of the original legal description, and also a river channel over here, or a tidal slough channel. So those would be the areas that would be added in with the amended language in 321.
Representative Sadler?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Meehan, you say things were inadvertently left out. Are you speaking from your experience as someone who inadvertently left them out, or how do you know they're inadvertently left out, or as Representative Elam said, there may have been a purpose for leaving certain areas out? What's your basis for that statement?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yeah, we're just assuming it was inadvertent, partly because of when these a lot of these areas were described in their legal definitions, mapping and aerial imagery was not as refined as it is now. For instance, the Fox River Flats one, which if I can try to get this to go back, basically this is tidelands that have accreted from rebound and are no longer tidelands, but they were described in such a way originally that they were tidelands. So when they rebounded and no longer became tidelands, they were excluded from jurisdiction. And so that's part of the inadvertent.
Thank you.
Sam, follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think for the record, we should be very cautious of changing law based on second-guessing what we think might be inadvertent. If there's clear discrepancies in the evidence or even, you know, I don't know, minutes or records of the discussions that reached these or inconsistencies in maps and words, that would be helpful and give me more comfort than just saying, we think they didn't mean to, so we're going to fix it for them.
Madam Chair, if I could real briefly, through the chair to Representative Sadler, I recall distinctly I was sitting there as co-chairman of Natural Resources, and in the Walker-era version of the bill, it was either Port Hyden or Port Mueller. There was a protected area, and literally, say, think of it as a rectangle, and then off that rectangle, there was a dot in the middle of not quite the Bering Sea. It's sort of the Northwest Gulf almost. And that was absolute inadvertence. This is just bad surveying or bad bill writing. There was no way that that dot, which was technically part of the refuge, was meant to be protected.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler?
Yeah, through the chair, I believe the redistricting board did that on purpose.
Oh, yes.
Yes,
yes. Yes. I read about that.
Representative Elam, then Representative Mears.
Thank you. I don't mean to derail your presentation here, but when we get into these Fox River areas, there's a lot of fishing communities around there with the old Orthodox believers in Ketchumak Silo. This kind of gets into that same water area there, and I know they use a ton of this for access, specifically to fishing. There's, you know, 100 community members down there. Do you know what kind of impacts these changes and restrictions would be for the Fox River Flats, and then as we get back up into like the headwaters? There's a lot of folks use that area back there.
Through the chair, Representative Elam, yeah, these should not impact access from either the local residents there or people that venture down in there. There's an established trail that goes down, as you may know, off the bench, down onto the beach, through the Fox River Flats critical habitat area and upland into a lot of private lands. But this adding these tideland areas that have now accreted won't influence that access at all.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mears, then Representative Klum.
Thank you, through the chair. I take Representative Sadler's point that in this case that you just gave us an example of, conditions have changed in 50 years. So that's a reason for some of these boundaries, some of these changes as well, that things just aren't what they used to be. So I think that's something we should keep in mind as we go through here as well. There's multiple reasons, I'm sure.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Representative Klum?
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, so I've been here. I got a place not too far from here. So is this, if you include this, does this have any effect on access, not just access to boats and four-wheelers, whatever, but my understanding is there's hunting down there, too. Would it change that?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, no, it would not change any hunting opportunities at all. The fish and games management of the special areas does not include hunting, fishing, trapping. That's all left to the boards. Access would be one. Access and land disturbing activities is really the purview of fish and game for managing these areas.
Follow up? And so, but you need a permit then? If Fish and Game is managing the hunting on it, so they would need a permit?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, they would only need a permit if they wanted to, say, drive an off-road vehicle or do some other habitat-altering activities. But to hunt, fish, or trap, no, do not need a permit. not a special area permit.
Not a special area. Follow-up? Because there's a lot of four-wheeling activities down there. So why do you feel like these two pieces are critical to include now into this area? What is happening on those areas that you feel like it needs the boundary needs to move up?
Through the chair, Representative Clum, it's just more of a housekeeping issue. Those particular areas are excluded from a special area jurisdiction. So they're just holes in the landmass within the refuge area. So it's just a way to basically for housekeeping to close that loop.
So one more follow-up? So there's not some kind of something happening with the animals there that we got to protect those, and you're just saying they should be included because the land around it's included.
Through the chair, Representative Clum. Yeah, basically. There's nothing happening there that I'm aware of. It's low-lying. It's probably pretty wet, so there's not a whole lot of activity down in there.
There's a lot of four-wheeling activity. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clum. I've got in the queue Representative Dibert and then Representative Elam again.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Meehan. Thank you for your presentation. I'm going ahead one slide to Eisenbeck Refuge. Last summer, I did get an opportunity to travel and see this refuge, and it's beautiful. And I can see there's a couple of red dots where you'd be adding protections or access. I guess it's access. Who do you talk to in Coal Bay to choose these sites? And then would you create trails to these sites, or what's the vision? I'm just curious. Thanks.
Co-Chair Dibert, for this one, for the Eisenbeck State Game Refuge, which, just to digress just a second, the lagoon itself protects one of the world's largest and most productive eelgrass beds in a marine environment, and there are nine small little pieces here in red all on the shorelines that are not captured by the current legal description for the State Game Refuge. So all this, House Bill 321 would do is add language to the legal description to include those small areas. There's nothing particular that stands out for those specific sites. Again, it's just trying to pull Eisenbeck and Moffett Lagoons in their entirety into refuge jurisdiction.
Okay. And Representative Elam.
Thank you. Going back to the Kachemak Bay area there with the Fox River area, would this change people's abilities to be able to move cattle? They have a lot of cattle back there that they herd, that they move back and forth, and you know, they do it through ATVs, but then they also, so is the moving of a herd considered destructive toward the land?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, no, this would not affect the movement of cattle down there at all. I've actually been down there on some of those cattle drives where they're using pickup trucks and ATVs and horses. And the grazing that happens down there is primarily done through Department of Natural Resources as far as the grazing leases go. Fish and Game also issues a habitat permit for the grazing down there and the use of the vehicles. But, no, this addition wouldn't affect that at all. And just a side note is that the Kachemak Bay Critical Habitat Area extends from the marine waters up to mean high tide. Mm-hmm. So if they're running on the beach above high tide, they're not even in the critical habitat area.
Okay, thank you.
Are there, seeing no further questions, please proceed with your presentation.
Okay, so we'll go past Eisenbeck. This one is for Tagetik Island, which is the very south end of the Kodiak chain. Right now, the area of jurisdiction for the critical habitat area is the lands and then the beaches down to mean high tide. This critical habitat area protects habitat for one of the largest harbor seal haulouts. As many as 20,000 harbor seals have been hauled out on this island in past decades. Numbers are way down now, but the historic numbers have been very high. Harbor seals generally haul out below mean high tide. So what we're proposing in HB 321 is not to change the external boundary, which is the red line you can see on this map, but it would be the jurisdictional boundary that Fish and Game has. Instead of ending at mean high tide, it would go down to mean low tide. So it would cover the area that the harbor seals are hauling out. Moving over into the Bristol Bay area, this is the Igigik critical habitat area, and this is one of the cases that Representative Josephson was mentioning. This is the current boundary of the critical habitat area, this black line plus the red. Clearly an error that was made in the mapping 30 or 40 years ago. It was supposed to be in this blue area, so HB 321 will just change that legal description to correct that error. And while we're on these critical habitat areas, the other thing that this bill will do, it doesn't show up real well, but this kind of lighter colored land here is native corporation or native allotment lands. And it's overlain by the critical habitat area designation. And the current statute allows Fish and Game to manage through habitat permits activities on those native lands. In our 2011 management plan development process, the native corporations and the villages in this area adamantly objected to Fish and Game having authority over their lands, whether it was building a fish camp, a drying rack, driving an ATV, building a cabin, whatever it may have been that would normally require a Fish and Game permit. They did not want that on their lands. To be honest with you, as a Fish and Game manager at the time, and our leadership at the time also did not want that. I could go into a little history about why the critical habitat area includes native corporation lands, but really the gist of this is nobody wants Fish and Game habitat permitting authority over native corporation lands. So HB 321 would remove that provision to have that jurisdiction over those private lands. And a similar situation is in the Pilot Point critical habitat area, also out in Bristol Bay. Again, you can see quite a few parcels of native corporation lands. The black line is the critical habitat area boundary, and the lighter areas are native corporation or native allotment lands. And so this bill would remove the jurisdiction over those lands. And there is an error, too, down here, this section down here, which I'll zoom in on the next map. This red section is one township off. It's supposed to be up here, which is illustrated there in blue. And again, more native corporation lands that would be removed from Fish and Game jurisdiction with this bill.
Representative Sadler?
A lot of this is absolutely accurate, but the implications for management and use and the effect on game, I think, is something we're going to have to explore. I hope we have the chance to do that because, yeah, a boundary change, but what does that mean for use of the land, for management of land, responsibilities, liability, access, all those things? You're giving us a landsman's perspective, and that's important, but we have to get into the policy of what this means for the use of the land.
Thank you, Representative Sather. Please proceed.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, good question, good point. Most of these changes are not really changing any purposes of what these areas were set aside for.
Not for purposes, but effects.
Madam Chair, if I might, I think what Mr. Meehan meant to say, through the chair, Representative Sadler, is the effects don't change either. It's he used the word purpose, but I think it's sort of the same. And that's true even when the definitions, when we move from these five different terms of art to describe a natural resource to refuges and sanctuaries for simplification. I don't think there's a material change in most of the usage.
Representative Sadler. And as you read through it, I can appreciate the simplification and the rationalization, you might say, of the different terminologies for protected lands, but still, and I don't know if the definition of refuges and sanctuaries, which in general understanding are kind of similar, but so I'm sure there are technical differences. But again, what gets down to me is I need to know what those are so I know what activities are prohibited or allowed or conditioned so that I can understand the effects. I understand this is a technical thing, and you have to address the technical, but maybe after we go through this, we can later get to the effects of these things on actual use of land. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, one thing I'll add too to that is generally what specific activities are allowed, not allowed, sideboarded, are developed in the management plan for these areas, and I'll get into that briefly here in just a few minutes. Okay, Port Hyden critical habitat area, also out in the Bristol Bay area. This one has no errors. Again, it would just remove the Native Corporation lands from the boundary of the critical habitat area. And then Port Moeller, again, Native Corporation lands. This is kind of a messy map. It's a broken up critical habitat area. All these black areas are part of the critical habitat area. And again, Native Corporation lands are removed from jurisdiction for special area permits. And as far as the error goes, this top map in red shows the areas that are in error. It's not showing up real well on the screen here, but basically these all needed to be shifted to the right where it's illustrated here in blue. They were just off by one township when they mapped this out. And just as a historic point, a lot of these errors were made because in the 1970s, the U.S. Geological Survey topographical quad map that was used had a printing error in it. So you can distinctively tie that back to that error from that map. In those days, they used maps to figure out the boundaries. Moving on to Port Moeller critical habitat area. This one does not contain any Native Corporation lands, and there are no errors. This one, we are just proposing to add these blocks in red to complete the protections for the lagoon of the Cinder River and the tidal flats that are here. This area, again, waterfowl, shorebirds, primarily using the wetland tide flats and intertidal areas. This would encapsulate all of the lagoons and intertidal areas in the Cinder River area. A little bit closer to home, the Mendenhall Wetlands State Game Refuge. There's one parcel up here in the northwest corner, Widgeon Ponds, that became private lands because of rebound, and the land was accreted, and in this case, deeded to the upland landowner, which was a private landowner. That landowner sold the land to the state, eventually to the state, and because it's within the boundary, the external boundary of the refuge, I should say, although it's in the external boundary of the refuge, it's not considered part of the refuge because the legislature never approved it to be within the refuge. And this is a good example of one of the other provisions of HB 321, is that any lands acquired in the future by the state within the external boundary would automatically become under refuge jurisdiction, rather than having to go back to the legislature every time some land within that boundary was acquired and adding it to the refuge.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at this map, I was going to ask earlier, where is this located? But I have discerned the runway, so I know this is up at the airport. And so just to clarify, so that tiny red square in the upper left-hand corner, that's the only piece of land that does the rebounded land that's affected by this this portion, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's the only piece of land affected by the boundary change and the addition. There's a lot of other private land that has been purchased by land conservation agencies with the potential of someday donating those to the state for inclusion in the refuge.
And is that the yellow, the light yellow?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yeah, light yellow is private land.
Okay, very good. And okay.
Yeah. Thank you. I can see where my house is.
Okay, going a little bit further north to the Palmer Hay Flat State Game Refuge. These three areas circled in red were acquisitions These two here were purchased with a national wetlands grant brokered by a land trust organization out of Anchorage, donated to the state for inclusion in the refuge. These two were donated to the state from the Mat-Su Borough for inclusion in the refuge. And again, since they were not state-owned at the time the refuge was created, they're not considered under refuge jurisdiction. So this bill would put them under refuge jurisdiction, and again, applicable to all these areas, any lands in the future would now be considered refuge once acquired by the state. This area down in here is basically accreted land again in Upper Cook Inlet, which is also rebounding from the 64 earthquake. And while this image may imply this is mudflat, this is actually uplands. It's wet uplands, but it's wetlands. And that has extended out into this area, very important waterfowl area. The two river channels, or the one river channel and the abandoned river channels over here, those are technically excluded from refuge jurisdiction because of the way the parcels are described. The parcels adjoining them were described by the high water mount, but they did not include the water channels themselves. The Matanuska River here has shifted and no longer flows there, but the parcels are still described by that old water channel. So these are basically just areas that are not included in the existing description, legal description of the refuge. Down on the Kenai Peninsula, we have the Anchor River Fritz Creek Critical Habitat Area. And down here in the southwest corner, which I'll zoom in on the next map. So here we have, and I say we, Fish and Game, when I was with Fish and Game, we acquired these lands here for conservation purposes, the solid red line land. They're bottom lands and important water courses, a tributary here to the Anchor River and the Anchor River here, which supports a world-renowned steelhead fishery. We're proposing to add those lands to the critical habitat area and renaming it refuge. This one parcel is a DNR general parcel. Again, contains important bottomland habitat, as you can see on the lower aerial image here. We have reached out to DNR to get their input on if they have any concerns about one of their general land parcels being incorporated into the critical habitat area, and we're waiting to hear back from them still.
Thank you. Representative Elam?
Thank you. So when you look at that and you kind of zoom in, there's the dotted square red box, but then there's also sort of the drawn line that comes off to the left of it there.
Down here.
What does that section to the left represent?
Through the chair, Representative Elam. This is my best ability to draw a line around this subdivision, and this subdivision has been purchased and donated to the state for conservation purposes. One large chunk of it was bought with Exxon Valdez settlement restoration funds. Another part of it was purchased with a federal wetlands grant. This land down here was donated by a conservation organization. So it's just, I was trying to draw a red line following the parcel lines.
Follow up. And so those are all currently under state ownership, and you're looking to expand this area into that?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, that is correct. We are. And one thing I should point out here, too, is that all these land additions that have been acquired for conservation purposes, they're already being managed by the Department of Fish and Game, the lands program, what I used to manage. And that does create some problems because we don't have regulatory oversight of those lands. Enforcement activities are problematic. We can't just call in the troopers to go cite somebody for dumping trash or cutting down trees or driving their four-wheeler they're not supposed to. In the refuges and critical habitat areas, we could, and they fell under refuge regulations, and the troopers could enforce that. So it actually makes it a little bit more problematic trying to manage these lands outside of the designated boundary.
If I may follow up.
I
know that area is heavily used, though. What sort of restrictions would this put on current land use that's being done publicly?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, it would fall under whatever regulations are for the critical habitat area. So there would be restrictions on off-road vehicle use, any habitat-altering activity, it would require a permit from Fish and Game. And I would say that any of those activities right now would be prohibited as the land owner and manager in those areas, the deed restrictions require they be managed for their conservation, fish and wildlife purposes. But trying to enforce any inappropriate activity, like dumping of fill, dumping of waste, would be somewhat more problematic to enforce if it's not part of the refuge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And before we move on to Representative Sadler, I just want to reflect let the record reflect that we were joined a while ago by Representative Eichheit, and I failed to acknowledge his presence in the room. So welcome to House Resources, Representative Eichheit. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Real quick, Mr. Meehan mentioned a conservation organization. What conservation organization donated that land, please?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, these lands were donated south of North Fork Road. Here was the Kachemak Moose Habitat Incorporated.
Kachemak Moose Incorporated.
Kachemak Moose Habitat Incorporated.
Okay. Hadn't heard of them. Okay.
Please proceed, Mr. Meehan.
Up around the Anchorage area, we have the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge from Point Warren's off, pretty much the entire coastline all the way down to the south end of Potter Marsh. And there are five parcels near Potter Marsh that we're proposing to add to refuge jurisdiction. For those of us that live in Anchorage, you might know the south end, often called the mailbox pullout site, currently being upgraded for use, public use facilities, parking lot, restroom, boardwalk, hopefully going in this winter yet. This is the old DOT commercial vehicle weigh station site, and Fish and Game is now using and managing that site under an agreement with DOT. We're proposing to pull those two parcels down there into refuge jurisdiction to give the department better ability to manage the sites. The parcels would remain in DOT ownership and oversight, but there'd be the refuge overlay on top of those. Another parcel along the old Seward Highway on the backside of Potter Marsh is within the boundary of the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge, but it would need additional authority from the legislature to add it in. But again, with the provision in HB 321, any future lands within the refuge boundary would be included so that we didn't have to come back and ask it for it to be added. So that one is within the boundary. It just needs concurrence that it's part of the refuge and under refuge jurisdiction. On the north end, there's one parcel that was acquired through a wetlands grant that would be added to the refuge. That's external to the boundary. And then a fifth parcel that has been in Fish and Game ownership for a long time. It was actually part of the old rifle range or shooting park parcel, but then it got bisected when the Seward Highway was constructed through it. And when the refuge boundary was drawn, it did not include that parcel on the other side of the highway. But again, Fish and Game manages it, and it would make it much simpler to have it within refuge jurisdiction to be able to manage it.
Representative Colomb has a question.
Through the chair, so these parcels right now, are they, I'm having a tough time delineating the yellows. Are these private or muni land? Like, are they all Fish and Game? Who has access or ownership of these right now?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, are we looking at this map here that I've got up on the screen?
Yes.
Yeah, it's primarily private land. You know, it's Anchorage, so it's mostly private lands. The refuge boundary is this black line that you can see here. So basically anything seaward of that line is going to be state ownership. There are some exceptions. Like in this area, there's private lands that go out into what we refer to as the mudflats or the coastal marsh. In here, too, there's a parcel of private lands that go out into there. But by far, this is all state land out here.
Follow-up? So is this proposing to take private land into the refuge?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, no.
Okay. So yeah. I guess I'm confused because of the line.
Yeah.
So right now, around Rabbit Creek Shooting Park, especially that top of the half, there's houses there. Does that affect the people that live there right now, even if it's just adjacent? So it's not their land, but it's adjacent to their land.
Through the chair, Representative Cologne. Yeah, these are all state-owned parcels, and some of them do border private homes and private parcels. But they're already state-owned. They're already managed by Fish and Game.
Okay. They're just going in. You're proposing they go into the refuge.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Going north to Creamer's Field. This area that's in red with the blue underlain was formerly University of Alaska land, and they sold that, brokered again by a land trust out of Fairbanks, and donated to the state for inclusion to the Creamer's Field State Game Refuge. And then there was also one private parcel that was purchased and donated to the state for inclusion into the refuge. Most of these lands were deemed undevelopable, which is part of the reason why the university didn't want to retain them.
Representative Southern?
I'm sorry, I need to interpret the map better. So right, is this status quo right now that the blue land is all state-owned land? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Southern, yes, all the blue is state-owned.
Okay, so the red hash-marked land represents what again?
University of Alaska land that was sold to the state for inclusion into the refuge.
So what? When was that?
I can't give you an exact year, but probably sometime in the past 10 years.
And follow up. And so therefore, in the last 10 years, so it's been, this is state land, so management has been different on it? And if it's happened 10 years ago, why do we still care?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yeah, and it may not have been 10. It could have been 7 or 8 sometime in the past, you know, decade. And it was state land owned by the University of Alaska. They could have sold it to private developers, other entities, but as a way of generating revenue, they sold it basically to back to a different part of the state for conservation purposes and for inclusion into the refuge.
I'm sorry. I feel like a... So it was state land from one agency owned it and sold it to another state agency?
Well, remember, we're talking university land.
Okay, it was university land. So it was university land. Now it's state land. Has the management changed at all? So why delineate this? If it happened 6, 8, 10 years ago, why is it still reflected in the map? I think I'm missing something here.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. When it was university land, it was their land to do with what they pleased. In order to conserve it, it was purchased from the university, donated to the state, to Department of Natural Resources. Department of Natural Resources is the owner of state lands. A fish and game cannot own land. Fish and game can manage land. Now, nothing has really happened on that land in the years since it was purchased. It's a natural state. And to add it to the refuge so it can be managed as refuge. Right now it cannot. It can be managed as refuge, but there's no jurisdiction for that management.
Okay. So what you're saying is it needs to have the formal refuge status. Okay, gotcha. Okay. And when you say it was donated, I think the state purchased, so paid someone for it, paid the university for it? The state paid the university, owns the land.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yeah, it was a deal brokered by a conservation fund, which is another land conservation organization using federal grants and other funds they have access to. And I don't know that they actually took deed ownership of it and then donated it to the state. I think it all happened in one process.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces. Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. There's a lot of moving pieces under this. So, again, a land conservation group bought the land from the university and then donated to the state. I mean, the more I probe, the more I learn here.
Yeah, well, again, I don't know that there was actually transfer of title to the nonprofit organization and then transfer of title to the state. It was probably all one real estate transaction that happened at once.
Thank you. Representative Dibert has a question.
Thank you, through the co-chair. To Mr. Meehan, can you, with the red lines and the red box, can you tell about the yellow corner? Is it private land or is that City of Fairbanks? There's a yellow corner.
Co-chair Diver, are we talking about up here?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah, that was purchased again by the Conservation Fund, working with the private landowner, and then transferred to the state. So that should be blue there, but this is the best I could do with that map. So anything in red is now state land owned by DNR and managed by Fish and Game, as if it were refuge, but regulatorily or statutorily, it is not refuge. It's Fish and Game managed lands for the refuge.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Please proceed.
Okay, we're almost through the maps. This one, just a little bit north of us, the Dude Creek Critical Habitat Area. This is the existing boundary, including mostly state lands. There is this block of school trust land, which is managed by DNR. The Nature Conservancy, another conservation organization, brokered a deal to purchase these lands down here, put a conservation easement on them, basically donate them to DNR for purposes of adding to the critical habitat area. So this bill would expand the boundary of that critical habitat area. Now, because it basically locks in this little piece of school trust here, the green is part of Glacier Bay National Park, so they really don't have access. So this bill would also guarantee any future owners of this piece of land access to get into that land should DNR ever dispose of that piece of school trust land. Okay, and that's it for maps. And again, I just want to reiterate, House Bill 321 will also automatically designate lands within the external boundary that are acquired from non-state entities. They'd automatically become under the jurisdiction of the refuge, rather than having these pieces within the boundary, then having to come to the legislature and have their addition to the refuge approved. I actually have two more maps. Just to
I can wait for the map.
Okay.
Okay. So this one is not talking about land status and ownership. We're zipping over to the McNeil River State Game Refuge and Katmai National Park on the Alaska Peninsula, Lower Cook Inlet. And as we've talked about, McNeil is the world renowned bear viewing site. Visitors from all over the world. Access to the sanctuary is by permit, done through a lottery by the Department of Fish and Game. Alaskans do get preference in that lottery system. At this area, bears are habituated. Many of the bears are habituated to human presence, and that's to distinguish it from food conditioning of bears. Bears here do not get food or garbage from people, and they also are not chased off by people, and that's the definition of habituated, is they tolerate people, but they're not attracted, they're not repelled by people either. Very managed program. No bears have ever been killed at McNeil, no injuries have ever happened. So very regulated program. For recognizing the area's value as a premier bear viewing site and the importance of the region's brown bear population, hunting at McNeil was prohibited first by federal law in 1955 before statehood, then prohibited by state law at statehood, and expanded by the legislature with the creation of the sanctuary in 1967, and then its boundaries were expanded in 1992. That area was closed statutorily to bear hunting. I note it's the only Fish and Game special area, again, refuge, sanctuary, critical habitat area, where hunting is closed by statute. And House Bill 321 is proposing to close some adjoining lands to brown bear hunting. The sanctuary is this inner dark line. Again, there's a lot of overlap with lines here. So this is the sanctuary. That's the area that's currently closed to all hunting, actually. The McNeil Refuge is open statutorily to hunting. Right now it's closed by Board of Game Action for bear hunting. And then south of the sanctuary, there's this parcel of land here and another small parcel down here, kind of sandwiched between the sanctuary and Katmai National Park. And these three parcels of land and the refuge are what we're proposing to also close to bear hunting through statute. The areas north here in the refuge, this has been closed for over 30 years to any bear hunting. The area south has been closed for at least 40 years, if not more. And, of course, the national park is closed to bear hunting. The bill does mention hunting closures on federal lands. That's kind of a moot point because, in this case, the lands identified in the bill that would be closed to brown bear hunting are not under National Park Service jurisdiction. So why do we want to close these areas adjoining McNeil if they are already closed and have been closed for decades? Well, one is to elevate McNeil Sanctuary as one of the world's premier wildlife viewing sites. It's to prevent distractions and conflicts when proposals are presented to the Board of Game to open these areas to hunting, which has happened in past decades. And to be honest, it ends up being a public relations battle, drawing national and international interest and conflict. And then lastly, closing these areas to brown bear hunting would perhaps show to the department's critics of predator control programs elsewhere in Alaska that there is a balance when it comes to managing bears.
Thank you. Before we proceed, Representative Elam had a question, and would you like to ask your question now?
Yes, I would. Thank you. You know, before we get too far past the maps, I appreciate your experience and time spent working with, you know, the maps and being in this. You know, you're definitely knowledgeable in this area, so I don't mean to take from that. In the past, whenever I have worked on realignments of maps and when we've done stuff with our GIS systems, particularly on the Kenai Peninsula Borough, we've recently acquired a lot of new maps and technologies. Have you been working with the departments and with the other, you know, agencies to make sure that these alignments that you're attempting to do are correct?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, when I was still employed at Fish and Game, yes, we worked with our in-house cartographers that presumably had all access to all the latest and greatest GIS and other programs. We also worked with the DNR surveyors to make sure the language is appropriate. And as Representative Josephson mentioned at the beginning, a lot of these land status maps were generated back in 2017, 2018 with a prior bill trying to address this. Now, a lot of these maps that I showed had my drawings on them because I had to take the old maps and either amend those, or since that 2017-2018 time, there have been new areas that needed lands added to them. We did request assistance from Fish and Game and DNR in coming up with new maps, but they weren't able to delegate the staff time to do that at this time. But the maps aren't necessarily what's adopted into statute. It's the legal descriptions. And those legal descriptions are in the bill, and that's really what is going to dictate what's done. And those, are I don't want to say they're 100% accurate. Presumably the DNR surveyors will review this bill when they have time to make sure there are no errors in there, but they should be very accurate.
If I may follow up.
So, if I understand correctly, you, because so like the maps, whenever we're, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this just a little bit, because again, I don't mean to be offensive by any means, but the maps that when you see like section markers and borders and lots and plots and all the easement access, they don't necessarily always line up, like you said, the actual lat and longs of all of the data that's in there. So how did you get this data for all of these pieces of land?
Through the chair, Representative Elam, for the newer ones that I had to come up with, I went to DNR and borough websites for parcel viewers and then used the legal descriptions that were online for those particular parcels. So as long as the boroughs and Department of Natural Resources had the correct meets and bounds and township range descriptions in their parcels, which I'd have to assume they do.
We didn't. That's why we were working on it. So, but okay, thank you.
And Representative Sadler?
Thank you. If we're kind of at a section, maybe I can make this comment. This bill is broad in its reach and scope, but it's very detailed in its particular application in a lot of places around the state. some very specific and particular and possibly quite impactful changes. But I must say, I cannot make decisions based on the maps I've got here. I can hardly read the lines delineating the sanctuaries and the lines, and I have questions about what the arrows and what covers and what doesn't cover. So I'm not sure what we have, but I cannot make a legitimate evaluation of the provisions of the bill without better maps that I can work with and ask questions about.
Representative Kolb.
Yeah, through the chair. So have, and maybe this is for the bill sponsor, I'm just curious, has the municipality of Anchorage or any of the boroughs been informed of this? Have you had any input on how they feel, the Bristol Bay region or KPB, how they feel about these pieces of land going into refuges?
Through the chair, Representative Kolb, I have reached out to a number of the boroughs, Aleutians East, Lake and Penn, Anchorage. I have not yet contacted Kenai Peninsula Borough. I haven't gotten any responses from them yet other than sending them the information, and they were going to look into it.
Okay.
In the city of Homer.
City of Homer.
We spoke to.
Representative Savage.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, I'm looking at the people that I would want to hear input from: Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mine and Land and Water, Alaska State Parks, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, the GIS Manager, the federal fish and game, fish and wildlife people, as well as the, Alaska Outdoor Council, resident hunters. There's other conservation and sport organizations. There's a lot of perspectives that have to be, I would like to have considered. And I know what it takes to make even changes to one critical habitat area, having lived through the Kachemak Bay personal watercraft wars. I'm really leery of, with one fell swoop and a large 80-page bill, making all these changes. I'm very cautious of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Souther. Representative Fields?
I was just going to ask, maybe we could ask the department just to use whatever data they have to double-check the map. Seems like it's a lot of research, and maybe they could just validate it.
I think... It seems like most of these have something to do with waterfowl hunting, and we are a big duck hunting family, so my little spidey sense is up. I guess I should know this, but the Jim Creek area, is that critical habitat in Palmer?
That's a special use area managed by DNR.
Okay. Can I have a follow-up? That never came up. There's nothing, you don't feel like there's any need for a different jurisdiction around that area?
Through the chair, Representative Kolb, no, that's outside fish and games land management area. It's not one of the areas that department manages. It's strictly DNR.
Yeah, and follow up. So I guess I'm confused because a lot of this is you're taking land from DNR or state-owned land and putting it under the jurisdiction of fish and game, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Kolb, no, it's not taking anything away from DNR. DNR generally is the land owner on behalf of the state, with some exceptions. University can own land, DOT can own land, fish and game cannot own land. And all these areas are co-managed, which I'm actually just about to get into a little bit. They're co-managed by DNR and fish and game, DNR being the land owner, fish and game being the surface land manager.
Okay, and one more question.
Representative Kolb.
Did any of these proposed changes around Potter's Marsh, does that change anything about the Rapid Creek Rifle Range? Does it affect that change, the shooting park?
Through the chair, Representative Kolb, none of the land additions do, but I do have some information coming up about the Rapid Creek shooting range.
Okay. Thank you.
I just want to take note of time. We've got about 20 minutes, 19 minutes left in committee. We'll proceed, Mr. Meehan, and then maybe we'll hold remaining questions for the end.
Okay. Co-Chair Fryer, I'll try to get through this as quickly as I can. So I was going to get into some of the management. Management of these areas is dictated by statutes and regulations, which are generally adopted through the management plans. And these directives provide good authorities for many of the activities, such as habitat enhancement and managing activities in these refuge areas that may have habitat impacts. However, the current authorities to manage public uses is somewhat lacking, and this bill will provide the department clear authority to manage public uses when warranted. And when might they be warranted? Well, unfortunately, some don't treat our public lands with respect. Some of our refuge areas have been grossly abused, including the dumping of hazardous waste. Old landfills, vandalism, abandoned camps, unauthorized cabins, off-road vehicle use, and a host of other abuses drain staff time and resources, not to mention potential impacts to habitat and wildlife. Abuses are difficult to address due to limited budgets, little staff, and unclear and weak enforcement authorities. During my 25-year tenure with the program, we overcame the budgetary and staffing limitations by working with dozens of partners, other agencies, community groups, friends groups, hunting organizations, neighborhood associations, friends groups, conservation and environmental groups, even bringing the military in to help us clean up some of these areas. Our goal has always been to clean up these areas, fix them up, add facilities, and attract legitimate users to displace the inappropriate users. We obtained millions of dollars in grants and funding from federal, state agencies, corporate entities, private organizations, individuals, and local municipalities. We utilized hundreds of community volunteers, scout groups, industrial and commercial donations of equipment and others. Compared to prior years, we've made great progress, and our refuge areas are now in much better shape. However, the department does need better authorities when it comes to managing public uses and public safety. This bill will clearly allow the department to manage users, user groups, and uses to avoid user conflicts and protect area resources. Target shooting, as an example, has been a big issue in some of the refuge areas, not only because of the debris that's hauled and shot at some of these access sites, but the lead contamination that's left behind. One site alone in the Palmer Hay Flats at Reflections Lake, some of us may be familiar with that, between the Bureau of Land Management, the federal agency, and Fish and Game, DNR, and DEC, we spent an estimated $2.5 million just cleaning that site up, excavating soils that were contaminated and shipping it to Oregon, which is the only place that we can dispose of lead-contaminated soil. We've also spent hundreds of thousands of dollars at other sites cleaning up lead contamination. In the bill, the provisions that we sent over to Legislative Legal, I requested that we give the Fish and Game Department the authority to limit target shooting at trailheads to avoid this user conflict, public safety, contamination issue. Leg Legal came back and said that's too narrow of a scope. It violates the Local and Specials Act prohibition in the Constitution. And so if you read the bill now, what it says is it provides Fish and Game the authority by regulation to close entire refuge areas to the discharge of firearms, with the explanation that once regulations are developed, that authority would be narrowed down to target shooting at trailheads and access sites. The other part of the firearms is, again, sending over to Leg Legal the idea of the Rabbit Creek Shooting Range, where, for people that aren't familiar with the Rabbit Creek Shooting Range, it's within the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge. Downrange is Cook Inlet, a lot of mud flats and marshes out there. Particularly in the wintertime, people will venture downrange of the shooting range, which seems ironic. What happens then, of course, the red lights go on, ceasefire's called, the range staff go out there, either a snow machine or trod through the marsh or whatever they have to do to get out there, ask the people to leave. Most people don't realize it. They miss the signs. There's a small contingent of people that don't like the firing range. They don't like Fish and Game's activity down there, and they will respond with, unless it's illegal for me to be here, I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to use this area. So what the provision in the bill would do is allow Fish and Game to, again, through regulations, close areas to public access for public safety reasons, with the intent that really the downrange area of the shooting range is the only one that would fall into that. But because of the way Leg Legal interpreted the Local and Specials Act prohibition in the Constitution, they had to make it much broader. And in the bill, it's worded that Fish and Game could, through regulation, adopt regulations to close entire areas for public safety reasons.
Thank you. Before we proceed, Representative Fields.
I don't know enough about public lands management to understand how incorporating these parcels in the refuges would make it easier to clean up abandoned vehicles and all that. Through the chair. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields. Probably wouldn't make it any easier to clean it up. It would be a lot easier to enforce the dumping in the first place. Somebody that's dumping in there, it would, you know, if you had a perpetrator in mind, you could just call the wildlife troopers. They would come and cite somebody. If it's not within the refuge, it's not a criminal activity, then you're talking about a civil action, taking the dumping party to court.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So fish and game over the decades has improved and upgraded many sites at multiple refuges to enhance public use and to promote appreciation and stewardship. It's come a long way. And since these lands have not been withdrawn from the public domain, they are still jointly managed by DNR and requires DNR concurrence. When I first started doing this work at fish and game, we got DNR approvals for building a trail, a bridge, a parking lot, an outhouse, an administrative cabin, whatever it may be, any kind of development activity, we would get DNR's approval for that. And they have a fee schedule for these type of authorizations, but their fee schedule provides a waiver for projects deemed to be in the public interest. And as the years went by, DNR had a policy change, and they insisted on charging fish and game upwards of $3,000 for each authorization. And we took that to our leadership at fish and game, who engaged in a long-time discussion with DNR leadership to iron this problem out, which was never resolved. So it basically evolved into a don't ask, don't tell kind of policy. And we just kept doing what we did and didn't get authorizations from DNR, and they didn't ask about it. But it doesn't make any sense to continue along those roads. From my point of view, it doesn't make any sense for DNR to charge fish and game tens of thousands of dollars to complete functions in special areas that the department's being basically directed to do by the legislature for public uses in these refuge areas. So HB 321 would prohibit DNR from charging fish and game these fees within legislatively designated areas. Moving down to Kachemak Bay, and I think the last issue we're going to bring up, very rich marine environment, marine mammals, seabirds. There has been a proposal to, again, ban personal watercraft, or jet skis is the brand name, in Kachemak Bay. There was a prohibition through regulation for 20 or so years in Kachemak Bay that was recently lifted, so that the personal watercraft are now allowed there. Our office was approached and asked to consider adding this prohibition back in to this bill, to reinstate the ban through statutory prohibition. And the concern with personal watercraft is basically just the way these machines are designed to be used, fast speeds, quick maneuvers, changes in volume, that the disturbance to other users was too great, and disturbance to wildlife was of the concern too. So in summary, the Fish and Game Area Special Areas Program, it's the largest and most varied state-run wildlife refuge program in the country. It's been the envy of many managers I interacted with from other states. These areas contribute greatly to our lifestyles and our economies, and while it's difficult to measure, my estimate was that we had over 1 million visits to these areas annually. And HB 321 will help the Department of Fish and Game more effectively and efficiently manage these valuable resources, and whether it's for consumptive, non-consumptive, subsistence uses, or general recreationists, while also protecting wildlife habitats and wildlife populations for future generations. There is a fiscal note from the Department of Fish and Game on this one. The fiscal note addresses mostly developing new signs and literature. However, there's nothing in this bill that requires the department to do anything immediately, and certainly the fiscal note could be reduced significantly if signs, particularly with new name changes, are just redone as they need to be replaced. And we do have some minor edits to the current version of the bill, and eventually we'd like to add one more refuge area for expanded. We didn't have the land status information when we had to get this bill in under the deadlines. So if the committee entertains this at a future committee hearing, we would be interested in trying to get some of those changes put in.
Thank you. Representative Coulomb and Representative Sadler.
Oh, through the chair. So I wanted to go back a little, back to the shooting range. Two things. One is, do you have an actual proposed area that Fish and Game would allow no public access downrange of the shooting range?
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb, I don't have anything on paper that's been drawn up. The idea would be to close the area downrange of the shooting range there at Rabbit Creek, where the existing signs are already placed going on out towards the inlet.
Follow up. Yeah, that's, I mean, people still hunt down there, so probably not right beyond the shooting range, but I know what you're talking about. The other thing is, so you were trying to explain that you're giving Fish and Game the power to regulate public access to certain areas that they could actually close areas. I mean, Rabbit Creek Range is what you mentioned, but this is like a blanket statewide. If they deem it necessary, they in regulation, they could close the public area, right?
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb, yeah, the way the statute's written, it would be the entire refuge would potentially fall under that statute. That's not the intent, though. The intent in this particular case would be just to close that area downrange of the Rabbit Creek shooting range, which you're right, people do hunt out there, and they do hunt out there on days when the range is not active and closed. Mm-hmm. So that would just all have to be worked with the Department of Fish and Game regulatory process to identify how they word that.
Okay. And one follow-up? So does this give the Fish and Game the power to close the access to hunt on certain grounds, too?
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb. I don't think that with the way it's written, it appears that that may be something that's allowed, but hunting is regulated by the Board of Game. So if by some odd future Fish and Game Department tried to close an entire refuge to hunting under that statute, that might be something that would need to be addressed by the lawyers or the courts. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine that would ever happen.
And just one clarification. So maybe I should clarify, can they restrict firearms can they like take swaps of the refuge and say you can't, even just a concealed carry, you can't have firearms in the refuge?
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb, I don't think so, but that might be a question for an attorney. But I wouldn't think that that would be applicable.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you.
If I could just add one more thing there, too. This bill actually reconfirms the public's right to carry and use firearms in these refuge areas, so I do stand corrected there somewhat.
Okay.
And if I might, real quickly, Madam Chair, I don't have the section in front of me, but there is an express section that does exactly what Mr. Meehan said. So it's a standalone section that reaffirms the right to Section 7. Section 7, lines 14 to 19.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're hitting time, so I'll just kind of do a wrap-up of my position and some thoughts. I would like to reiterate for the record just a few of the things that I would like to have, that I would need to have if I'm going to be able to develop a meaningful position and views on this quite expansive bill. Those include information, a chart about the status and designation of the different terms like wildlife refuge and sanctuary and critical habitat area, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to have better maps that I can look at and review and ask questions about to the people that know about them. The paper ones that are a packet are insufficient. I'd like to have input from land owning and management authorities on the state and federal and local levels, including local landowners and local governments. They have a role in this too, and this pertains to their bailiwicks. I'd also like to have input from outdoor advocates like the Alaska Outdoors Council, Resident Hunters of Alaska, the National Rifle Association, because this might impinge on their use of these public lands as well. So it's an ambitious bill, and it may be a great bill, but I want to be able to make good decisions on it. So I hope we do take our time on this, Madam Chair.
My intent was to just move it right. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, if I may. Representative Sadler, we have reached out to various organizations, Safari Club International, Alaska Outdoor Council. I'd have to go back to my computer, but I have started that process of reaching out to a lot of these other entities.
Good. Appreciate it.
Ducks Unlimited,
yeah. Alaska Waterfowl Association.
Good. Wonderful. Are there any further questions?
Is he waving goodbye?
That is a really cute photo of the Ivic. All right. Well, seeing no further questions, we'll now set this bill aside. And that completes the agenda for House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting is Friday, March 6, 2026, where we'll take up the governor's appointees for the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environmental Conservation and hear public testimony on them. The time now is 2:59 p.m. Great timing. And this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.